Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 28th of February 2016. My name is TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Gareth James, Nick from Partially Obstructed View, and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about War of the Worlds at the Dominion Theatre. This is Jeff Wayne's rock musical version of H.G. Wells' story. It's been done at the Dominion Theatre, which, I don't know, it feels oddly fitting that it should be there. To me, it's the home of those bombastic kind of musicals with great science fiction credentials. I mean, once upon a time they did Time there, which was Dave Clark's musical, I think, which had Cliff Richard and Laurence Olivier as a hologram. That ran for a couple of years. And, of course, the thing that the Dominion has been doing for over a decade now is We Will Rock You, which is a bizarre science fiction piece based on Queen's music. Actually, this musical has a better original plot, being the H.G. Wells novel, and came out at about the same time in the mid-70s that Queen were producing some pretty good music. So it is an interesting connection, and it's something that I think quite a lot of people are aware of the music here. Certainly the opening theme, which is used throughout the musical, the dun-dun-da, everybody is familiar with that. It gets used all over the place. There's also a single called Forever Autumn, which was done by Justin Hayward. I had a hit with it because he was playing the journalist. So on the face of it, it might be quite attractive, this musical, especially when you consider that we've got Jeff Wayne playing the music and conducting the orchestra. We have a voiceover from Liam Neeson as the journalist. And we've also got people like Jimmy Nail, Michael Praed, and David Essex. And David Essex was in the original concept album of War of the Worlds. So it does seem to be quite attractive. And even for the younger people, as you would say, we have people like Daniel Bedingfield and Heidi Range. Daniel Bedingfield, who's a pop star, and Heidi Range, who was, for about a decade, was in the Sugar Babes. So it looks as if it could be rather attractive and a rather fun piece. John, was it in any way?
You're right that it could be a fun piece. And for those who are devotees of the music, I think there's nothing you can do to the production that will dent their enthusiasm. And I'm now rather enjoying the fact that at 5 to 9 every night, Twitter and Facebook just explode with members of the audience tweeting and messaging how dreadful this is. And then people who actually like it contradicting them. I mean, I can take or leave bad productions. You know, we all take the rough with the smooth in this game, and you can't expect to like everything you volunteer to go and see. But what slightly annoys me, really, is that the American owner of one of the largest theatres in London, which could house any number of first-rate transfers from Broadway or British provincial musicals, persistently serves up tripe. I am what my primary school headmistress used to call disappointed. You mentioned We Will Rock You, which I think ran for about 14 years or something like that. I mean, really very successful. And I believe it's during the time We Will Rock You was running that Nederlander organization acquired the Dominion and had to wait until the show closed before they could do a refurbishment. The refurbishment's excellent. It really is a very comfortable theatre. The sight lines are tremendous for a big London theatre. There are almost no bad seats. It's only on 2 tiers. It's got a huge stage. It really does deserve to be the place where we present some of our biggest and best musicals. Instead of which, they seem to have resorted to cheap dross. You know, White Christmas was just overpriced on a stick, in my humble opinion. And everyone knows that, you know, Elf was tremendously overpriced until they changed the seat prices to accommodate the audience. And just because this Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds doesn't have the nerve like Elf to ask £240 a ticket, doesn't make the decision to revive it any better, in my book. It has been around too long. What are we thinking? In late 1970s, about 78, something like that, when he wrote this famous prog rock double album. But he wrote it at about the same time that Pink Floyd were producing Dark Side of the Moon and The Wall. And their musicianship really crowned the prog rock era and sort of laid the genre to rest. There wasn't very much of it afterwards. So I think Jeff Wayne himself, who is now, I believe, 72, deserves medals for persevering with it and still thrashing through this score night after night on the conducting platform. So it is remarkable to see him do that, and all power to him and to the money that he has obviously made from this one double album over so many years. It must be the most extended franchise I can think of in rock to musical theatre. It's a highly portable show as well. He's toured it everywhere from Belgium to Bali. And I was surprised to read again from Twitter that there were severe technical issues in the early previews. And the first preview had to be cancelled. And the sort of disappointment voiced on social media split almost equally, as I say, between the diehard fans of what is apparently the 39th most popular album of all time, who had come from the country and paid train fares and hotel bills and things like that, and missed their date to see it. And then those who turned up the next night for the what should have been the second preview was actually the first, and then hated it. But I've been in touch with people who've seen it at all stages, including press night, and it's still not a good show. And I see already it's heavily discounted and papered, and you know, it's the kind of thing you can pick up quite easily for not very much money if you really want to see it. If you do see it, my recommendation is you don't sit too near the front, because part of my disappointment with it was the disjunct between what the singers were trying to sing and act, and the hologram and the back projection and the overpowering sound from the orchestra. But for the second half, I moved towards the back of the auditorium and the blend was much better from almost the back row. Also, you didn't see quite so much of the distortion on the screen of the CGI, the back projection. So it all became a little bit more comprehensive. I didn't mean I liked it, but it meant I got it a bit more. You've mentioned the castings. Again, these are people who are individually extremely capable at what they do, but when they work collectively, it does not make a good show. Part of the problem, I think, is having Liam Neeson as a hologram. I can't believe that it's so necessary to have one expensive actor speak these words that once were voiced by Richard Burton. There are plenty of people who can work as well as Liam Neeson in this particular situation, and for a lot less money. I know the Dominion has a history of holograms, as you mentioned, Time, but I think it's the first time they've had one made entirely of wood. You know, what are they all doing? The staging appears to be that, you know, the music is thrashing away in the background, and the characters sort of run from the wings to each other, collide in the middle, and there's either a romantic moment or a violent moment or some kind of exchange. They sort of chest bump each other and run off again in opposite directions. It's very active, and you know, it's a great aerobic workout for the actors, but it doesn't say anything. And again, with the relentless loud music, you would have to semaphore any emotion if you wanted to get it across. And then the other thing is that it's like an endless demonstration in the motorized blind department of John Lewis. There are these roller blinds that go up and down and up and down and up and down every damn scene, including one onto which Liam Neeson is projected. I mean, they say a hologram. It's like a projection at school, really. It's the kind of thing we used to watch instructional videos on sex education. It's and about as exciting. So I just didn't get all of that. It's overstaged, underwritten. I couldn't tell you what the story is about. I mean, I know it's about the invasion of the Martians, but even that is underdone. It's because it's done mostly in film. And there is one Martian kind of walking machine that comes on. But I have to tell you that, you know, a lot of the audience around me were not young. Obviously, you have to be in your 50s or 60s to really have been part of this generation of musical appreciation. And quite a few of them were fairly camp. And when the Martian walking machine came, I heard on all sides people going, they peel them with their metal knives, in homage to the 80s Smash Instant Mash advert, because that is exactly what it looks like. Something else that makes it suffer really is Welles's vision of what the War of the Worlds would be like has been almost too faithfully adhered to. He thought that the red planet of Mars was red because it was infested with a kind of red ground weed, and that's what then takes over Earth. But of course, we know now that the red colour of Mars is more to do with the gases that surround it than to do with plant life. So a lot of red plastic plantage wiggling around isn't very funny. And none of the staging is clever. I'm sure it doesn't feel as if it's developed much since they first did this as a stage performance. So you have, you know, a lot of flashing light. Now it's done with LED, which points directly at the audience. I mean, you can get free laser eye surgery by watching this show because the LEDs just flash red and green and blue and gold and fuchsia. And, you know, part of the fun of the show really is guessing which one comes next, because that's all it does in terms of lighting. And again, there is so much more you could do with actual lasers, for example, nowadays, if you put some more money into the show. But again, no one has. There's a nice trough of fire that runs along the very front of the four stage and shoots flame upwards or side, diagonally, but you know, not very far. There was a woman on Twitter who said that she had her eyebrows singed by it, but I really think she was exaggerating. However, you know, if you are going and you get a seat in the front row, you might like to take a big bag of marshmallows and a pointy stick. Anything to amuse yourself, really.
We're now going to talk about the encounter, which is being presented by Complicité at the Barbican Theatre. This is being directed by Simon McBurney along with Kirsty Housley and is being performed by Simon McBurney. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Well, it's the story of an American photographer called Lauren McIntyre and his kind of adventures up the Amazon, as it were, where he meets some people called the Mayaruna people. But it's told by a writer called Petru Popescu, and this is therefore an adaptation of his book, which is called The Encounter Amazon Beaming, I think. And I never really kind of grasped how it got from sort of Lauren McIntyre's story to being told by Petru Popescu, but there you go. But certainly this is an adaptation of that book, and that's where Simon McBurney takes his lead, really. It is a monologue, and I'm famous for not liking monologues, but it is a monologue with a difference because it's got a soundscape that actually makes it much more than that. So he actually uses the sort of sound technology to expand and illustrate and bring out something completely different from the story. It's still storytelling, but he brings out something completely different, and I thought kind of quite extraordinary, really, as a result of that. You wear headphones throughout the show, although you don't wear headphones at the beginning because he's talking direct to the audience. And through those headphones, I mean, and very sophisticated sound system, I have to say, you hear a combination of live and recorded dialogue and indeed sound effects. And that's, I think, adds this kind of enthralling dimension to this story, really. I felt it had a kind of hypnotic effect on me, really. And it kind of really drew me in very quickly and kept me for a couple of hours or so. He does at the beginning quite sort of playfully address the audience directly, and during the show he interweaves dialogue with his daughter, which sort of comes from, you know, him preparing the show in the bedroom and her coming in and out of the bedroom, and that kind of brought you back to earth every now and again. And I think in a way without that it might have been a bit too much and a bit too earnest. But it's a very captivating story. I mean, it's a bare stage that's just kind of littered with microphones and things that he uses for sound effects, and they're not all high-tech things, you know, there's sort of bottles of water and pieces of paper. But when those sounds kind of go into your head through this very sophisticated sound system, it really is quite different. He narrates throughout, but he's also kind of moving around the stage creating these effects, so he is both McIntyre and indeed a narrator and indeed others as well, really, and he creates these effects while he's speaking to you. So it is, I think, quite a virtuoso performance. And in a way, you know, it's the Barbican's a big theater, and you know, one man on that Barbican stage creating this is, I think, quite a tall order, really. So I thought it, I mean, it worked very much for me. It worked on a lot of levels, and it made me think about lots of different issues. It makes you think about, well, lots of things, really. And the packed house, which I think is every night, or certainly packed on the night I went, sort of lapped it up. I mean, it's inventive, it's intelligent, and I found it a very captivating experience. So despite my dislike of monologues, this one I really loved. What about you, Nick?
I don't have anything against monologues, but I couldn't warm to this one. Possibly literally, because it's 2.25 hours and I was sitting, I don't know whether it was the air conditioning in general or just where I was sitting, and I was right under a blast, but it was incredibly over-enthusiastic, and so it was basically 2.25 hours for me being freezing cold while listening to a story about the jungle. So I don't think being uncomfortable helped much, but I did really love the way that the story is told. I did love that it's so cleverly put together, and I mean, obviously the technology is very impressive. And there's kind of a central piece of technology in there is this microphone shaped like a head, and basically wherever he stands in relation to the head, that's where you hear him. It's as if he's standing there in relation to your head through the headphones. And it's not just the technology that's clever about it. It is the way he uses it and kind of the juxtaposition of live narration and pre-recorded narration. And you don't always know which is which. I mean, he makes a point of this quite early on when he's introducing the way it works, where he's been doing a lengthy speech to you with his back turned, and then, you know, he turns around and the speech keeps going and he's not talking. And the structure of it, where the story is kind of interrupted every so often because he's pre-recorded it. We get these scenes where he's doing the pre-recording and is interrupted by his daughter in the middle of the night. So I did really like the way it was put together, but I think the central story of this man who kind of gets lost in the jungle and spends time with the tribe and goes on this kind of hallucinogenic trip with them, and it just didn't grab me in the end, and I thought it was just dragged out very much. So I loved the way it was told, but what it was telling didn't really feel particularly new or interestingly done to me. I think possibly also I've been hearing for months, because this, I think, played in Edinburgh. I think it was only last year, but I have been hearing people raving about it for months, and that's the best thing that's ever happened. So it had quite a lot to live up to, and although the way it's told definitely did, I didn't think the overall effect quite did it for me.
We're now going to talk about Uncle Vanya at the Almeida Theatre. This is Chekhov's play in a new version by Robert Icke, and Robert Icke also directs it. It's actually a modernised version of the play, where Uncle Vanya, indeed, is known as John, which, of course, is, if you know your name translations, Vanya goes to Ivan, and I think Ivan goes to John. So it is an anglicisation of the play and an updating, although they're not going around putting mobile phones in case you're worried about that sort of thing. The cast is Jessica Brown-Finley, Vanessa Kirby, Richard Lumsden, Hilton McRae, Tobias Menzies, Anne Queensbury, Paul Rees as Uncle Vanya, or Uncle John, and Susan Waldridge. And we have a set, rotating set, by Hildegard Beckler. Nick, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
So this is one of the Chekhovs I've not seen as many productions of as some of the others. And it's also one I've never seen until now, a production I've liked. But I have only seen two previous productions, and they were kind of noted for being particularly awful. So it's probably not necessarily down to the play. But this is the production that I really, really liked. And that's kind of despite a very lengthy running time. It's well over 3 hours with three intervals. But in the defence of the Almeida, I think possibly they've also had some practice with Ike's Aura Style last year, and the ushers are very good at actually keeping the intervals at 10 minutes, unlike the Old Vic. It's kind of, especially at the beginning, it's a tricky one for the company to get your interest, because it is very much about people who are bored in the first act. And in the context, it's quite a strange thing for them to be, because these are people who are always working hard all their lives. It's a working farm. And it's a farm that was owned by Uncle Johnny's sister, who's now died. And it was kind of a dowry when she married Alexander, Hilton McRae's character, who was kind of a noted academic. And basically, John, Paul Rees, and his niece, who's played by Jessica Brown-Findlay, have spent the last 25 years working on that farm and keeping it profitable so they can send the profits to keep Alexander and make sure he can keep doing his important academic work. And I think there's two things that have kind of stalled everybody's enthusiasm and everybody's productivity on the farm now. And that's that Alexander has now come back to, he's retired and he's come to live on the farm. And one thing that's caused the problem is that they've actually spent some time with him and very quickly realized that he's not quite the great man they thought he was. He's a very minor academic and very derivative. And basically, they've spent their lives kind of paying for a legacy that they've realized that as soon as Alexander dies, that legacy is going to go with him, because nobody's really going to care about anything he had to say. He's not a particularly important thinker. And the other thing that's happened is that he's brought with him a new, much younger wife, Eleanor, who's Vanessa Kirby's character. and she's kind of captivated all the men on the farm, and they've kind of become distracted. So these people who've come back are now sort of the topic of discussion, and everybody's sort of sitting around not knowing what to do with themselves. But as you get into the next three acts, all these tensions start to come to a head, and they start being discussed. And it's an increasingly intense show, and it's essentially about people who've starting to feel like they've wasted their lives. I think what Robert Icke's doing, and what he tends to do with these very long shows, and I think hopefully he doesn't get too confident in them, because this is something that can backfire really badly if he gets too used to doing these really long, really slow shows. He's doing something incredibly difficult, which is to make something very slow and a very long show, and to make it kind of captivating. And I think we're going to hear in a bit that it doesn't work on everybody, but it did work on me. I did find it very involving, and I thought there's some lovely performances in there. You've got Jessica Brown Findlay, she's playing Sonia. She's got a kind of lifelong unrequited love for the local doctor, who's Bias Mingus's character. And he, of course, if he cares about anybody, it's Eleanor, same as everybody else. And I think there's a very good performance in a very difficult part by Vanessa Kirby, because Eleanor's kind of a character who even she sort of admits is not actually that interesting. She's just very attractive, and people kind of assume that she must have a personality as well, but she kind of doesn't really think she does herself. And I think Vanessa Kirby does a lot with a character who doesn't get very much to do. Although Robert Icke has added these little moments, as you say, the set is this revolving frame, and there are these moments where some of the characters step out of it to talk to the audience directly and kind of give you an insight into that. And she is one of the characters who gets one of these moments. So she has some help from Robert Icke in kind of making something of this character. But I think it's an overall very strong cast, and it's going to suffer from not being the Orris Dyer. I think that was just so good last year that it's always going to stand up to comparison. But I still thought this was excellent, and really kind of against the odds, really, of a story about not a lot happening and it not happening over quite a long time. I just thought it really got me involved and really dragged me into it. But I think we might have a different opinion from Gareth.
Yes. Well, in addition to being famous for not liking monologues, I'm also famous for not liking Chekhov. So you'd be forgiven for wondering why on earth I bothered to go and see it. And the answer to that is that I thought Robert Icke might sort of do something with it. I thought he might sort of animate and make the play more interesting. And I very much liked what he did with the Orris Dyer, where he took three longer plays and turned them into something shorter and punchier. And indeed, what he did with 1984 as well. So I kind of, in the same way as Jamie Lloyd has made me relook at Pinter, I was kind of hoping that Robert Icke would make me relook at Chekhov. But what he's done, in a way, is he's made a paint-drying play make the paint dry even slower, really, because he's added almost an hour to the running time of the play. He slowed the play down quite considerably. And it's still, or perhaps even more so, a play of deeply uninteresting characters who I can't identify with at all, who are themselves bored, boring me, really. So I was hugely disappointed, because I thought, you know, here's the man to shake it all up. And he just slowed it all down. I couldn't fault the staging or the performances, but I thought the revolve was quite a good idea, although it's been used before quite a bit now, but quite a good idea for this play. And I thought the performances were all very good, but I was frankly just bored out of my mind, really. And in addition to lengthening it, he also puts in these 3 10-minute intervals. And by the second 10-minute interval, I'm afraid the temptation was just too much to resist for me. So my confession is that I didn't even see the whole thing, because I broke after the second interval and thought there's better things to do with my life than listening to irritating, uninteresting people going on about nothing. So I'm afraid nowhere near radical enough and nowhere near enough of a reinvention for me. So Chekhov goes back in the box. I've seen Uncle Vanya a few times, and this is probably the slowest and dullest of the Uncle Vanyas I've seen. So not for me, I'm afraid.
I was slightly different to you and closer to Nick. I did think this was a rather good production. It does have a lot of favourites in it. People like Paul Rees, who I used to say was my favourite ever Hamlet, mainly because it made me sound cool. but he was very good at that, and he's always a welcome person to see back on stage. And we also have Vanessa Kirby. I got into a Twitter conversation about Vanessa Kirby because she has made an awful lot of extremely good choices, or has got a good agent. Because if you look at her record, I mean, she was in A Streetcar Named Desire last year or the year before, and she also did a rather radical Three Sisters at the Young Vic. She's made an awful lot of very good choices in her work, and she's getting to be somebody who's extremely well, I think, very well respected in the theatre. There's sort of other actresses of her generation who are also interesting. I mean, I think in particular of Lydia Wilson, but perhaps it is Vanessa Kirby who's going to come out in front because of the good choice of roles and the good choice of the classic roles that she's been doing, and also, you know, also some interesting new work that she's been involved with over the years. But overall, this production, I liked the modernisation. I thought it was rather clever. It's interesting that the monologues that Nick mentioned, they're actually from the text of Uncle Vanya. And I honestly didn't feel the length. I mean, I've been to some extremely long Chekhovs over the year, and I have persevered. So I'm hardened to the boringness and the bored people talking about being bored. But I didn't find this particularly boring in itself. I thought they were doing the play rather well. I think I may have seen some finer ones. In fact, there was one done at the Print Room with Ian Glenn some years ago, and in fact, the picture of Paul Rees on the poster reminds me a lot of William Houston, who played the Doctor in the production with Ian Glenn. As I said, I've probably seen better Uncle Vanyas over the years, but I was quite impressed by the modernisation of this play. They caught a sense of it being around about today without, as I said before, without sort of needing to put in mobile phones or anything like that. So you did have a contemporary feel without ramming its contemporaneous down your throat. It just felt at the same time modern and also something that wouldn't date, which I thought was done really rather well. So, you know, I was impressed by this, and I, as I said, didn't feel the time. But other people, I mean, obviously, it's 3 hours, and we'll have a different feeling. And if you're not really into the play, I suppose it's okay to feel that you can escape in one of the intervals. We're now going to talk about Rabbit Hole at the Hampstead Theatre. This is written by David Lindsay Abaire, and is directed by Edward Hall. It stars John Delaney, Penny Downey, Tom Goodman Hill, Georgina Rich, and Claire Skinner, and concerns a couple who ought to be a happy suburban couple, but something shocking happened a year or so before the play begins, and they are dealing with that shock. Webb Cowgirl, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
A little bit of background. Rabbit Hole is by David Lindsay Abaire, as you said, who won a Pulitzer Prize for this play back in 2007. But it is just now making its debut here. He previously had Good People on at the Hampstead Theatre, which I saw with Imelda Staunton in the lead role, and that play convinced me that I was seeing a work by an incredible talent who was capable of bringing the natural language of everyday American people on stage. And Good People focused on very poor people from the lower echelons of Boston society. Rabbit Hole is focused on the sort of standard middle class America, once again on the East Coast. And the principal conflict is the couple, Becca and Howie, dealing with grief at the loss of their son. You would think that this play would be histrionic and over the top, people tearing their hair out, being ridiculous, but instead it very effectively captures the quietness of grief and the pervasiveness of its effect on people's lives. It's not about going around tearing your hair out, you know, fighting with the king for the ability to bury your brother's body. It's not about that. It's about looking at a sock and feeling destroyed that it doesn't matter if you find the mate to that sock because the person that you bought it for is never going to wear either of them again. And wanting to throw it out and feeling that getting rid of this thing that you don't need anymore is essentially another goodbye. And for me to talk about it just using normal words like that, it sounds, you know, so ridiculous that you could get worked up over a sock. But when you're actually going through the experience of grief, every goodbye is painful. And in watching this play, you get to see every goodbye that these people are asked to make throughout the course of this play. And Becca is not dealing with it very well, and Howie's also struggling. But what makes it so crushing is that these two people who you would think are going through at least a similar experience, because it is, you know, both of their child, they are so broken, they are completely incapable of reaching out to each other for support. And that doesn't sound like this would make for a great night of theater, but I was entranced. And I found myself utterly believing in their situation and in the characters. I don't want to say too much about some of the small details that made it come to life, but Becca's mom has also lost a child because she lost apparently her son, Becca's brother. And Nat attempts to give her daughter some advice about how you live with grief. Her daughter isn't really ready for it, but I can say that actually what the playwright has this woman say is very accurate, and it's good advice and it's realistic. And I took great pleasure in watching this extremely naturalistic, heartbreaking play about people struggling with a pain that few people have to deal with.
Gareth?
Yes, I mean, I admire this play great. And it's only the second David Lindsay Adair play that I think we've had in the UK. And as Webb Cargill said, Good People was the big hit of a couple of years ago with Imelda Staunton. And I think what I like most about seeing this play is that even though it's got some similarities, it's actually fundamentally a very different play from Good People. It's much more gentle and much more sensitive. And I think it was great to see the same playwright writing something so different. It's not without its humour, but the humour is a very different sort of humour than the acerbic kind we saw in Good People. And it still touches on the kind of class theme, because both the mother and sister come from a very different part of suburban New York State. And that dimension comes in as well. But it is fundamentally a play about differing responses to grief. And we have the mother who copes alone, really. I mean, she doesn't like reminders. She wants the reminders removed. She wants to just cope alone. Whereas Howie, the father, joins a support group and he likes reminders. So they're approaching grief in very different ways, and they can't do it together, I guess. And it therefore strains their relationship. And this other loss that the family has had before is seen very differently by the mother and sister. And I think the whole thing is just very delicate, very moving, and really does make you think. It's got a lot of depth, a lot of breadth, and it's very much its own play. And I've seen plays about grief before, but this one seemed very real to me. I think that both the direction by Edward Hall and all of the performances are very sensitive to the piece. So I think they do kind of, you know, add a lot to that. They're very empathetic and very sensitive to the material. And I think that the staging and actually Martin Davidson's design somehow makes Hampstead Theatre more intimate, because you've got three sides and you've got four sort of sets there. And somehow you do feel very much involved in what's happening on the stage. The audience is almost kind of wrapped around the stage, and it's an unelevated stage apart from sort of certain parts of the set in it. So I just found it a very thoughtful and a very thought-provoking evening. I think what I like about his writing, now I've seen both plays, I really like the way he structures his plays. And I particularly like the way that he doesn't really waste any time. You know, every moment in the play matters. Every word matters. Every scene matters. Every gesture matters. And I like that kind of economy. So, you know, only the second David Lindsay Adair play I've seen, but one that now sort of puts him in a category of playwrights that the minute I see his name against a play, I'll probably
probably book, because I think the two plays together have shown a playwright with great depth, but also great breadth, and I very much was very glad. I mean, say enjoy is the wrong word, I suppose, but I was very glad I went to Hampstead to see this play.
Yeah, he's on my life list of must-sees now. I'll go see anything he writes.
Yeah, me too.
I will only say that there was another production of a play called Fuddy Mears.
Very different, though.
Yeah, it's a very different play.
His early plays, I'm told, were kind of a bit manic and a bit farcical, but his later plays he's kind of grown into this more mature, more naturalistic style, I think, hasn't he?
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.